KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
And the Supreme Court issues a weak order that I think suggests it's now afraid of the constitutional crisis that would come if the Trump administration were to ignore its rulings.
Is what we're living through right now a constitutional crisis, or better framed as a Supreme Court crisis?
For Friday, April 18th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 10 years ago, the killing of Freddie Gray put a Baltimore neighborhood in the national spotlight.
How has it changed in the decade since?
Where's the hope? 10 years later, we're still standing here asking, where's the hope? Where's the change?
Also, TikTok has been flooded with videos from Chinese manufacturers urging Americans to buy directly from them.
Claiming they make exact replicas of luxury goods for a fraction of the price.
If you fold a piece of paper once over, that's pretty easy to duplicate. But if someone folds it into this like origami, like Hermes does, then it will be harder for someone to duplicate that.
The Chinese luxury goods conspiracy after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Fresh from El Salvador and a visit with Kilmar Abrego-Garcia, Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen told reporters at a Washington area airport that the man removed suddenly to a notorious maximum security prison was shocked by his apprehension and removal. Abrego-Garcia told Senator Van Hollen that he did have concerns about his security at El Salvador's Cicot prison and that 9 days ago he was moved to a different facility. Van Hollen declared it's time for the U.S. to honor Abrego-Garcia's rights.
The White House and the president have been lying about this case from the beginning. They've been trying to change the subject from the beginning. As I said, and the courts have said, from the Supreme Court to the Fourth Circuit to the District Court, what this is about is adhering to the Constitution, to the right of due process. That's right. And that's why we say, bring Kilmar home so he can be afforded his rights under the Constitution.
Abrego-Garcia tearfully told Van Hollen that he wished to see his wife and son again. The Trump administration is moving forward with reclassifying 50,000 federal workers, making them easier to fire, part of mass firings under Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reports.
Today, the Office of Personnel Management proposed a rule that would move the reclassification process forward. Trump will still have to sign another executive order to implement it. The policy is also known as Schedule F, and it would remove federal civil service protections from around 2% of the federal workforce, according to the White House. Those workers would instead be at-will employees who serve at the pleasure of the sitting president. The president wrote about the policy on social media on Friday, saying, quote, "If these government workers refuse to advance the policy interests of the president or are engaging in corrupt behavior, they should no longer have a job." Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
A dozen aid groups operating in Gaza have published a joint statement saying the humanitarian situation there, from food to vital supplies, is at breaking point. NPR's Aya Batraoui has details.
The Palestinian Red Crescent says only 3 out of 30 of its ambulances in Gaza City are operating because there's no fuel. And all of Gaza's bakeries shut down weeks ago because there's no flour. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, says the blockade is a tool to pressure Hamas, and this week said no humanitarian aid is going to enter Gaza. He says any future mechanism for delivering aid would include the use of private companies. A statement signed by 12 aid groups in Gaza, including Oxfam, Doctors Without Borders, and Medical Aid for Palestinians, says this new mechanism Israel's considering for allowing aid into Gaza would set a dangerous global precedent and eliminate any remaining space to deliver aid independent of military and political motivations. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
This is NPR. On a plaza at Florida State University tonight, students, staff, and faculty have gathered in the thousands to commemorate the 2 dead and 6 hurt when a gunman opened a shooting rampage Thursday. Authorities say Florida State student 20-year-old Phoenix Eichner took less than 5 minutes to inflict the destruction. He's in custody after police shot and wounded him. The National Science Foundation, a government agency that's a major funder of science and engineering research, has started canceling numerous grants. As NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports, the NSF now says these projects are not aligned with agency priorities.
In 2010, Congress told the NSF to support efforts to expand the participation of women and individuals from underrepresented groups in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But NSF now says it's ending funding for projects that involve diversity, equity, and inclusion. The agency says projects designed to boost participation need to be broad engagement activities that don't favor or limit the participation of any particular groups. NSF also announced it will not support any research with the goal of combating, quote, misinformation or, quote, disinformation, saying it's a matter of free speech rights. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
South of Naples, a sightseeing mountain cable car plunged into a ravine Thursday, killing four people, including the Italian driver of the car. Three tourists died, including two British visitors and an Arab woman with Israeli citizenship. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. A cartoon this week in the New Yorker magazine shows a reporter standing before the steps of the Supreme Court. Into her microphone, she intones, "Today, the Supreme Court is expected to rule in the case of People v. Guy who will ignore the ruling." Like all political cartoons, this one is designed to capture a moment. And the moment in which we find ourselves presents a mounting number of legal cases where the Trump administration appears to be avoiding or ignoring court orders. I want to focus now on two of them. Both relate to immigration policy. One involves Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act, the 18th century wartime law to deport migrants without due process to a mega prison in El Salvador. The other involves another person deported to that prison, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who the government admits was wrongfully deported and is now refusing to retrieve for the hearing that the U.S. Supreme Court says he is owed. So he and all the others remain in El Salvador. Well, let's turn to someone to help us make sense of this, Amanda Frost, law professor at the University of Virginia. Amanda Frost, welcome back.
Thank you.
First, the case involving the Alien Enemies Act. This week, Judge James Boasberg ruled that there is, and I quote, probable cause to find the Trump administration in criminal contempt for violating his orders last month. What would that mean exactly, to be held in criminal contempt?
Yes, so criminal contempt is the power that all courts have to hold the lawyers in front of it in contempt. That means to fine them or even imprison them if they've lied to the court. If they've refused to follow its orders or violated its orders. Judge Boasberg, in a 46-page opinion, laid out very clearly all of the ways in which the executive branch and the lawyers before him mischaracterized, obfuscated, and raised frivolous, meritless arguments to avoid his court order, which would have prevented these men from being wrongfully and illegally deported.
The Supreme Court has also ruled on this case, and in a way that I have seen described as a win for the Trump administration and simultaneously a rebuke to the Trump administration. Explain.
Yes, the Supreme Court's decision was deeply frustrating for those who, like myself, feel these men were deported in violation of the Constitution and federal law. The Supreme Court said, yes, they have a right to notice and due process, which was violated in this case. That is such an important statement because, of course, the Trump administration was claiming they had no such right. But at the same time, the Supreme Court said, but they litigated in the wrong forum. They have to start again. They have to bring it in a different jurisdiction. That is extremely frustrating for the rule of law and for the rights of these men and future people who may be wrongfully deported.
The second case I mentioned, this was also this week, Judge Paula Zinnes announced a two-week expedited discovery over the Trump administration's refusal to return Kilmar Albrego Garcia to the U.S. The Trump administration appealed. A federal appeals court has now denied that appeal. It's a lot to keep up with. Legally, where does it leave us?
Yeah, so I'll just start with the fact that Albrego Garcia was wrongfully deported, as the government concedes. He had a court order allowing him to stay in the United States. The government's view is, despite the error, they have no obligation to return him. Of course, Judge Zinnes ruled against that position, said, yes, you do. You must facilitate and effectuate the return. The Supreme Court then backed her up, but I would have to say weakly. They said, yes, government, you must try to return him. But they didn't use the strong and clear language she used, and the government is now taking advantage of the leeway the Supreme Court gave them to do, at this point, nothing. And Judge Zinnes has responded by pushing this forward with a two-week investigation as to what the government is doing.
So let me focus us on the Supreme Court. I'm listening to the language you are using in describing the Supreme Court's recent actions. You have called them deeply frustrating. You've said they moved weakly. It sounds as though they are issuing rulings that are so carefully worded that they tiptoe up to wishy-washy.
Yeah, I think wishy-washy is the right word. And if the Supreme Court spoke clearly and firmly, then in cases where the law is crystal clear, as with Albrego Garcia, who was wrongfully removed in the government's own admission, then I think we could see a response. President Trump said, if the Supreme Court orders him returned, I will do it. And then the Supreme Court issues a weak order that I think suggests it's now afraid of the constitutional crisis that would come if the Trump administration were to ignore its rulings.
Amanda Frost, we have interviewed you twice in the last 2 months, and both times we have asked whether, with the executive branch appearing to ignore the judicial branch, are we in a constitutional crisis? Listening to you, it sounds like you see this more as a Supreme Court crisis right now than a constitutional crisis.
I think that's right. When we spoke before, I defined the constitutional crisis, or what one would be an open flouting of the orders of the highest court in the land. It would be, no, we do not have to follow the Supreme Court's rulings. This administration isn't saying that, and it actually doesn't need to say that in light of the frustratingly weak Supreme Court rulings. What it is doing is making a mockery of the judicial process by returning to the lower courts and obfuscating, mischaracterizing, and making frivolous and meritless arguments before those courts in ways that suggest that it doesn't need to openly flout orders as long as it can get away with this kind of misbehavior.
For the migrants who are now sitting in a prison in El Salvador without due process, does the distinction between a constitutional crisis and a Supreme Court crisis matter?
No. For them, the result is the same. And I think it's worth adding here that they're the tip of the iceberg. We have the migrants that the president said it could deport without due process, in violation now clearly of what all agree the law is. Then we have an individual wrongly deported. And then we have a president saying he can deport citizens, that he plans to look into deporting homegrown Americans, as he puts it. So there's no endpoint to the president's claim to be able to have unilateral power to remove people from the United States of America without due process.
Amanda Frost is a professor at the University of Virginia specializing in immigration and citizenship law. Amanda Frost, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, it seems like every week there is a new main character, right? Someone or something that the internet is obsessed with. And I try to keep up with all of it, but I don't inhale social media the way that some of our resident young people do, like our producer, Mia Venkat, who is always there for anything that I missed. And she is here with something new. Mia, hello.
Hi, Elsa.
All right, so tell me, who or what is everyone talking about this week?
All right, Elsa. The main character this week isn't a person, but it's a concept. It's the Chinese luxury goods conspiracy.
Wait, what?
Okay, yeah. So this one does require some explanation, obviously. But it starts with these super viral videos that have been flooding TikTok all week from Chinese manufacturers.
Yeah, actually. I saw this one guy who basically claimed that he makes Hermes bags in his factory. Like, basically the same bag you would buy from Hermes.
Yep, that's right.
Let me guess, it's totally genuine.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. But so this video, The one that you're talking about is from a TikTok user named Senbags, but that name has changed a bunch because some of his accounts have been suspended and videos have been taken down. But I saw one video with over 10 million views before it got taken down. By the way, I did reach out to Hermes on TikTok. Hermes has not responded and TikTok has declined to comment. But here's a clip of that video.
But why Hermes will charge you $38,000 for one bag? That's because more than 90% of the price is paid for its logo. But if you do not care about the logo, you just want the same quality, same material, you can just buy from us.
Wait, people are paying $38,000 for one Hermes bag? What?
That's the thing. That price isn't right. And so he's claiming that his bags are exact duplicates of a bag that, you know, luxury brand Hermes offers for a fraction of the cost. And that's not true. I'll explain the rest later.
Uh-huh.
But that's just one video. There have been tons of viral videos with similar claims that American consumers have been duped by brands. And not all luxury either. But American consumers have really responded to this.
Wait, but haven't counterfeit goods always been a thing everywhere on the internet? Like from lots of different countries? Why are we hearing these videos going viral now?
Yeah, I think there's a few things at play. First, there's a lot of confusion about tariffs in the U.S. right now. And it seems like these videos are kind of targeted at that, and they're capitalizing on that uncertainty. But also, people love feeling like they're in on a deal. If a shirt's on sale, my mom is going to buy it in every color. That is the only certainty I have in this life. And then the last thing is, people love a conspiracy. They want to feel like they're in on a big secret.
Oh, totally. Who doesn't want to be in on a big secret? But wait, you told us that what that first guy claimed was not true. How do you know?
That's right. So I wasn't sure at first. It's a compelling video. You know, it got me. So that's why I called up Derek Guy. He's been a fashion writer for 15 years, and he posted a couple threads debunking these claims. He says that the bags the man was selling might be great quality, but they're definitely not Hermes. That video raised some red flags for a few different reasons.
He wouldn't discuss the stitching or the work that goes into it. That seems strange. He wouldn't emphasize the craftsmanship. The price was wrong. The price of the components are wrong. And also the thing that he named was Togo leather in the video was not actually Togo leather.
He told me that it has gotten really hard to detect fakes now because they've just gotten better. A lot of goods have gotten simpler.
If someone gets a Balenciaga t-shirt, I don't know if it came from the original factory. And even if it didn't, it's not that hard to duplicate because it's just a very simple item. If you fold a piece of paper once over, yeah, like that's pretty easy to duplicate. But if someone folds it into this like really complicated origami like Hermes does, then it will be harder for someone to duplicate that.
Okay, so yeah, there may be lots of high quality knockoffs out there for all kinds of stuff, but not for complicated Hermes bags.
That's right. Derek Guy says everyone everywhere is always trying to sell you stuff. So it's on us as consumers to have a critical eye.
There are many, many companies, including in China, that make quality goods that may advertise on social media platforms. But not everybody is telling the truth. Evaluate whether this is something that is actually worth purchasing.
And that's because, as you know, Elsa, the idea of a good deal can be very, very tempting.
But sometimes too good to be true, right?
Yep.
NPR's Mia Van Kat with this week's main character. You are so awesome, Mia. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers in Baltimore, reporting from a quiet block of a West Baltimore neighborhood. It's spring break. Children are out of school, but the basketball courts and a nearby park are all empty. Brightly colored murals climb along the concrete retaining walls that surround a neighborhood rec center, but the doors are locked. It has been closed for roughly 4 years.
Downtown Winchester community is a loving community. It is a community where neighbors care for each other. You know each other.
That's Tracy Malone. For her, this rec center is more than just a building. Sitting at the center of this small neighborhood, the rec center is where she made lifelong friendships.
I grew up here. I grew up in Lillian Jones Rec Center. My mom still owns a home here. I said my brother was murdered in this same community, and I am here giving back to this community because he was a kid that gave back.
Even though Malone has moved out of this neighborhood, she's the executive director of the Sandtown Winchester Community Collective. She's organized behind the cause of reopening the rec center and, in turn, making this neighborhood a place where kids can thrive, can see a future. As we talk, she gestures around.
It was just deserted. The weeds were growing extremely high. There was way more trash than it is now. That playground is still messed up. It's like a sinkhole playground.
And for some who are invested in this neighborhood or have roots here like Malone, this rec center has become a symbol of what Sandtown could be.
Where's the hope? 10 years later, we're still standing here asking, where's the hope? Where's the change?
10 years ago this month, the death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray put this neighborhood in the national spotlight. He was arrested in a public housing complex in Sandtown called Gilmore Homes and placed in the back of a police van. As Gray was being transported, he suffered a severe neck injury. Gray died in a hospital about a week later.
The Lord giveth,
the Lord giveth,
and the Lord taketh away.
The medical examiner for the state ruled Gray's death a homicide. The officers involved in his death were ultimately acquitted. Gray's treatment at the hands of police sparked protests across Baltimore.
You're going to see tear gas. You're going to see pepper balls. We're going to use appropriate methods to ensure that we're able to preserve the safety of that community.
Police came and blocked off everything. An animal that's blocked off is going, you feel me? They're going to run away to get out. So people start moving. Police start getting more aggressive. Before anything happened, they started firing smoke screens and all that and made everything violent.
Freddie Gray was just the lighting of the fuse that blew up the cake.
That's Pastor Dwayne Simmons. I meet him at his church in Sandtown. When we sit down in the church central office, there's a room full of people next door.
We deal with over 1,000 people who have an addiction problem. We feed about 400 to 600 people a week with no money, because here at Simmons Memorial, we believe that need should be the driving force of your ministry, not surplus.
Simmons has been leading this church for decades, since 1990. And in 2015, when Freddie Gray's death sparked an uprising in Sandtown and across the city of Baltimore, he says the church provided resources and safe haven.
3.5 weeks, we never closed. 24 hours. It was the safest spot in which to be, because not a glass was broken on this church. We were present, helping, lifting, encouraging.
After Gray's death and the unrest that followed, politicians made a number of promises to Baltimore. Then Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake promised $4.2 million for programming for young people. There was a program launched by the mayor and Maryland's governor at the time, Larry Hogan, to demolish vacant buildings and rebuild blighted blocks. There were also promises to pour more resources into Sandtown. Tracy Malone remembers pledges to address vacant housing, construct a community youth center, to create more accessible green spaces, among others.
But Simmons and others say many of those promises never materialized, and that after 10 years, there's waning attention.
The politicians that represent this community are never here. They rub shoulders with the aristocrats, but barely speak to the proletariat.
Some change did come to Sandtown and to Baltimore. The Department of Justice investigated the city's police department, finding that it disproportionately targeted Black people for stops and arrests, among other things. And the city entered a consent decree in 2017 to address those issues.
Oh yeah, you did get an upgraded police station in the last 10 years.
That's Tracy Malone again. The skepticism on her face is clear. Several years ago, the city, in partnership with private donors, overhauled the Western District Police Station that serves Sandtown. But there have been setbacks here, too.
We had a young lady who was murdered in front of this rec center. The young people were unable to return because once we shut down a rec to figure out how we can do trauma-informed response to having them come back, someone stole the pipes and the wiring.
This is James Torrance, the Baltimore City Councilman who represents this neighborhood. He says there is still a lot of need in Sandtown, and community members are stepping up to make sure needs are met.
People are actively loving on each other. This community is close-knit. They were creating pop-ups on this field right here. They painted this mural here along the rec center. It was a collective energy. There's a youth league that's here every Saturday in the summertime that does football and lacrosse, and it's a Christian-based one where young men are being engaged from throughout the city and come here.
Dr. Al Stokes is part of Clergy United to Transform Sandtown. His organization coordinates the youth sports at the park just across the street from the rec center, among some other initiatives. The church he leads is in Sandtown, but he's now living in a different neighborhood in Northwest Baltimore, something that gives him perspective.
I've got four different places I can go and buy bread or meat or shop at. There's no place down here. We're in USA. We're in Maryland, a wealthy state. We're in Baltimore. We have the Ravens. We have the Orioles. And you mean to tell me we have no place to shop? No place that our seniors can shop. That's deplorable.
Still, Baltimore City Councilman James Torrance tells me that part of his job is showing members of this community that their government can meet their needs. Take the rec center, for example.
People think they're left behind. So the apathy for people is high, but it's also getting the trust so that they can come back out and trust us. The fact that they were a little scared when we told them, tell us what you want for your rec center. They're like, what's the budget? Dream.
And the input from Sandtown, Torrance says, is the reason that for now, plans are on track to bring the rec center back.
There's been a consistent voice among the Black women that are leading this movement in this neighborhood that we want this thing and this is how we want it. And when I say they leave no room without a commitment, every time I met with them, a commitment was made and it had to be followed through. And then I think that's the next thing. It is about the follow through.
Torrance says the city hopes to start building a $26 million new facility by 2027.
This community still needs to heal. And how do we heal besides coming together? We are creating hope here in Sandtown. Regardless of all the money that came that did not stay here in Sandtown, Sandtown still thrives.
And part of Tracy Malone's hope is that a new rec center can create the same kind of connection for a new generation of Sandtown's young people that she found decades ago.
This is NPR News.
Garry Kasparov, the chess champ, grew up under Soviet rule and considered the U.S. a beacon. But he believes current U.S. policies dim that light.
What Trump is doing now, it's destroying American reputation. Because America is now, it's not so much America first, but America alone.
Garry Kasparov and his new newsletter, The Next Move, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsie Chang. President Trump has threatened to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status.
There is one historical precedent, a Christian school that decades ago barred students from interracial marriage.
It's against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and so it's contrary to public policy.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump says the U.S. plans to finalize a rare earth minerals agreement with Ukraine next week, but as NPR's Greg Myrie tells us, Trump and his advisors are sending mixed messages about what the administration's role will be in the Russian-Ukraine war.
The deal on valuable minerals was supposed to be signed when Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the White House in February. But that meeting descended into a shouting match and the agreement was postponed. Trump now says it will be signed next week. Still, Trump says this about Zelensky.
I wouldn't say he's done the greatest job. Okay. I'm not a big fan. I really am. I'm not a big fan.
Separately, Secretary of State Marco Rubio indicated the U.S. was growing frustrated with efforts to broker a peace deal in the Russia-Ukraine war. He said, quote, if it is not possible to end the war in Ukraine, we need to move on. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
Measles have been detected in Montana for the first time in 35 years. State health officials there have confirmed 5 cases so far. From Montana Public Radio, Aaron Bolton reports.
State health officials announced the cases in southwest Montana's Gallatin County Thursday evening. They say all 5 people were recently traveling but did not say where. The individuals are either unvaccinated or have an unknown vaccine status. County health officials say everyone has been isolated but say people in the community were exposed. Montana only has estimates for current vaccination rates. That's because a 2021 state law told schools to stop reporting vaccination rates. Legislation to restart that data collection has stalled in the state legislature. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Columbia Falls, Montana.
And you're listening to NPR News. In Massachusetts, festivities celebrating the 250th anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord are underway, marking start of the Revolutionary War. From member station WBUR, Miriam Wasser reports.
Every year, reenactors in full costume and with 18th century muskets recreate the so-called shot heard round the world in Lexington and the battle at the Old North Bridge in Concord. But this year's celebrations are going to be different and a whole lot bigger. Local officials are expecting hundreds of thousands of history buffs from around the country to attend. There will also be a live reenactment of Paul Revere's famous horse ride, big parades, several fife and drum corps, and a skydiving performance by the U.S. Army's Golden Knights parachute team. For NPR News, I'm Miriam Wasser.
Capital One's merger with Discover Financial Services has cleared another major hurdle today, credit card regulators giving the green light to the $35 billion deal for Capital One to acquire Discover, merging the two companies into the largest credit card company in the country. That deal announced over a year ago would give Capital One a leg up on its competitors as well, providing a new source of revenue from the merchant fees it would collect on transactions. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
On a Friday, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. In an escalating fight with Harvard University, President Trump has threatened to revoke the school's tax-exempt status. While this would be an extraordinary step by the Trump administration, it is not entirely unprecedented. There is one university that decades ago did have its tax-exempt status rescinded. That was Bob Jones University. NPR's Janaki Mehta joins us now to talk about what we can learn from that case. Hi, Janaki.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, before we get to the story of Bob Jones University, can you just bring us up to speed on where things stand right now with this whole fight between Harvard and the Trump administration?
Yeah, it's been a lot and it's been fast. So at the start of this week, Harvard told the Trump administration it would not comply with its order to overhaul the university's hiring, admissions, and other policies, including its DEI programs. The Trump administration then fired back by freezing over $2.2 billion in funding for the school. And then in a post on Truth Social, President Trump threatened to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status. NPR reached out to both the IRS and the White House for more on that threat, and neither responded. But on Thursday, President Trump told reporters administration officials are assessing next steps.
Okay. So tell us how Bob Jones University can help us understand what's happening with Harvard right now.
Yeah, so Bob Jones University is this private Christian college in South Carolina. It had a policy that barred its students from interracial dating or marriage, and that led to the IRS revoking the school's tax-exempt status in 1976. Here's Olatunde Johnson, a law professor at Columbia University, who's written about the Bob Jones case.
The IRS said racial discrimination is so firmly against the U.S. Constitution. It's against the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And so it's contrary to public policy.
Bob Jones fought back, saying that because the Bible said racial mixing shouldn't be allowed, the IRS was infringing upon their religious freedom. The case eventually made its way to the Supreme Court, which in 1983 ruled in favor of the IRS and against Bob Jones, saying by discriminating against black students, the university was violating a, quote, fundamental national public policy, and so it didn't qualify for this tax-exempt status. In the year 2000, the university did end their ban on interracial dating or marriage, and in 2017, they had their tax status restored.
Okay, so how does that case about interracial dating or marriage apply to Harvard here?
Yeah, so Bob Jones had a policy that was clearly in violation of laws that would allow it to keep receiving this tax benefit. And since the Trump administration has repeatedly made claims that Harvard's not doing enough to address anti-Semitism, it could try to use the argument against Bob Jones in a case against Harvard. Here's Larry Zelenek, a law professor at Duke University.
I guess the argument would have to be that the alleged anti-Semitism on the part of Harvard would be the equivalent public policy violation to the racial discrimination in Bob Jones, and I just don't see the comparison there.
So unlike Bob Jones University, it's not an official policy of Harvard's to discriminate against any group of students, including Jewish students. And so the legal experts I spoke with don't think that argument would go very far in court. In a statement, Harvard also told NPR it believes the Trump administration has no legal grounds to take away their status. And experts told us if the administration does pursue this, it could take a while. Olatunde Johnson from Columbia pointed out that in the Bob Jones case, racial discrimination was explicit in its policy, and it still took years for the university to lose its tax status.
Okay, so in this case, I mean, how legal is it for the president of the United States to revoke the tax-exempt status of Harvard?
So there's some nuance there, Elsa. The IRS does have the power to revoke tax-exempt status. We saw that with Bob Jones. But federal law bars certain members of the executive branch, including the president, from using the IRS to target specific taxpayers for political means. There's a history of presidents trying to weaponize the IRS to go after their political enemies, which is part of what led to that law that I mentioned. So if that is what's proven to be happening here, that would be illegal.
That is NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta. Thank you so much, Janaki.
Thank you, Elsa.
unintentional injuries are the leading cause of death for people under the age of 45. So many people in public health are alarmed that earlier this month, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. cut much of the workforce at the CDC who focus on preventing injuries. NPR's Will Stone reports.
Just before they were fired, CDC staff were ready to launch a new data system to accurately track concussions. They were planning to release guidance on traumatic brain injury in children and publish findings on drownings after natural disasters. They were gathering data on overdoses and suicides to forecast trends and studying how people were dying in car crashes. This is the kind of work that stopped with the layoffs, according to five CDC staff whose jobs were eliminated. NPR is not using their names because they are on administrative leave and not authorized to speak to the press.
The cuts to the injury center were devastating.
Sharon Gilmartin directs Safe States Alliance, a nonprofit that works closely with CDC and local health departments. Her group has tallied more than 200 job cuts at the injury center.
Motor vehicle crashes, child maltreatment, rape prevention and education, drowning prevention, all of that has been completely eliminated.
Gilmartin says some were spared, including the overdose division, but others doing critical work are also gone, like the branch that crunched all the numbers and maintained a key national database on injuries, tracking suicide attempts, drowning, sexual violence, and so on. Kristen Rexing leads the Society for Advancement of Violence and Injury Research.
That's one of my concerns, is that we will not have this comprehensive surveillance system, so we will not know what is killing us.
Injury data may end up scattered, and some data won't be collected at all. For example, the CDC kept up a close-to-real-time picture of injuries in the U.S. based on ER records at about 100 hospitals. The Consumer Product Safety Commission, which partnered with the CDC on this, told NPR they were directed to stop this work and will only focus on products. CDC also funds work on injury prevention in states and universities. The staff who handle that are gone, and advocates believe the funding will dry up too.
I do see it as a collapse in the field, the development of the field, the knowledge we already have.
In response to NPR's questions, the Department of Health and Human Services said in a statement that critical CDC programs that help research injury and violence prevention will continue as a part of Secretary Kennedy's vision to streamline HHS.
If you stop the work, if you stop the research, if you stop these programs, then the results could be disastrous.
Dr. Mark Rosenberg was the first director of the CDC Injury Center.
All along, this has been a bipartisan effort. There's nothing partisan about injuries. These are our kids who are being shot, our kids who are drowning, our kids who are being abused and neglected.
The scope of this work is incredibly broad, and we take it for granted now. Safer car designs, bike helmets, smoke alarms. Rosenberg says the CDC helped drive all of this over the years, and it's especially relevant today, with crises like drug overdoses and gun violence. Beth Morocco directs the UNC Injury Prevention Research Center.
This is critical work that's been done at such a low cost, with such a high return. And a lot of it's unseen, right?
Because when no one gets hurt, it doesn't usually make headlines. Will Stone, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. The Dadaab refugee camps in Kenya shelter hundreds of thousands of people who have fled war or drought in nearby countries. Many people in the camps cling to the hope of resettlement abroad, in countries like the U.S. But in January, President Trump abruptly halted refugee admissions, and now many there are waiting anxiously to see if the program will be resumed, as Emmanuel Igunza reports from Nairobi.
What was supposed to be a temporary haven has now become a place of permanent limbo for many here in Dadaab. Over the last three decades, thousands have built their lives in this barren, dusty sprawl of refugee camps in northern Kenya, raising families waiting for resettlement. Home to over 400,000 mostly Somali refugees, many cling to the hope of resettling in countries like the U.S. Refugees like Farah Abdigaid, who lives with a disability, he has been in Dadaab for over 30 years. Gade had cleared all background checks, undergone medical screenings, and secured a plane ticket to travel to the U.S. But then in January, the news that everyone had been dreading, President Trump signed an executive order temporarily suspending the U.S. refugee admission program. My plea to President Trump is to reconsider his decision, he says. Many of us have waited decades for this opportunity. Please don't destroy our dreams. For many here, including Gade, this is the second time they've been affected by a Trump executive order. The first back in 2017, when the travel ban against seven Muslim-majority countries, including Somalia, came into force.
Since he started elected, my heart was broken.
Across the Atlantic in Dallas, Texas, Gade's sister, Shandez Abdi Gade, was devastated when she was told that her brother's travel plans had been canceled. Now she fears they may never be reunited.
My blood pressure and my sugar is so high because of the stress I got from the refugees are not coming to this country anymore.
The current freeze on refugee resettlement is under review. In the next few days, the Department of Homeland Security will decide whether or not the resumption of the program is in the, quote, interests of the U.S. But this current crisis for refugees extends far beyond the resettlement delays. In recent weeks, there have been protests in camps including Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camp in northwest Kenya, with people demanding access to food, water and shelter. Trump's freeze on foreign aid and dismantling of USAID has led to reduced food rations and scaling down of other essential services, and people here are frustrated.
A huge chunk of the refugee response in Kenya is supported by the United States, upwards of 70% of all the food.
Abdullahi Boru Halake from Refugees International wants that food assistance to the refugees in camps could run out completely by April.
For the Somali refugees, all the three options are getting narrower now. Somalia is not yet peaceful for them to go back to. Kenya, they do not get all the support that they would want. And thirdly, the United States shutting any door or any opportunity for them to relocate.
The situation in Dadaab is dire, with rising desperation leading to a rise in suicides and a growing feeling of hopelessness and abandonment, according to Refugees International.
Let the people come and they reunite their families.
And for Gade's sister in Dallas, there is a passionate plea to President Trump.
Don't stop. We need each other as sister and brother.
For now, Dadaab provides shelter, but no clear vision of a future in a place where the prospect of a new life feels more distant with each passing day. For NPR News, I'm Emmanuel Igunza in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
and I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Each year, the State Department releases its country reports on human rights. Now, these are what they sound like, closely read reports about human rights practices country by country. They track things like the right to privacy and freedom of expression. Well, now NPR has obtained internal State Department documents that show major changes coming this year. Graham Smith is with our investigations desk. Hey, Graham.
Hey, how you doing, Mary Louise?
I am all right. I am curious about these internal documents that you have obtained, including, I gather, one that outlines a whole host of human rights being dropped from this year's reports?
Yeah, the main thing that I got was a document describing basically how these reports are supposed to be edited down. It's a whole list of kinds of rights that should be stripped out. You mentioned the rights to privacy. That's going to go away. It needs to be taken out. Also, freedom of assembly, the right to free and fair elections. It tells editors basically to remove anything that isn't specifically called for in the law that asks for these reports.
Huh. And when were these reports completed?
These were completed in January, just before President Trump took office, but his State Department came in and wanted to basically change what was in these reports.
Hmm. Okay, so let's make this specific. Give me an example of a specific country and how the report on it has changed or will change.
Yeah, let's take the case of El Salvador. You look at the report for 2023, you look at the report for 2024, this one is way smaller. Sources at State told our Michelle Kellerman that the goal is to reduce the length of these reports by two-thirds. And in this case, they overshot. It's come down nearly 70%. Of course, with recent events, the Trump administration sending immigrants to be jailed there, I went looking right away for the section that covers prisons.
Yeah.
You look in the 2023 one, there's this huge section covering the poor conditions there, the lack of good food and water, access to medical care. In this 2024 report, all of that is gone. The whole section on prison conditions is gone. There are some details about prison deaths because there's a required category on extrajudicial deaths, but none of the other stuff.
And then other categories, whole buckets of things disappearing. I'm curious, for example, about LGBTQ rights and how those are going to be tracked and reported on.
They're not going to be reported on. In fact, the guidance is to remove any reference to LGBTQ people and violence against them. Also, violence against disabled people, sexual exploitation of women and children. There's one section that used to be in the report about denial of a fair public trial. You look in the El Salvador report, and it says that the government theoretically provides for fair and public trials, but in El Salvador, they're operating under what they call a state of exemption, which suspends those rights. And so the 2023 report says under exemption, they allow trials of up to 900 people at a time, and that's a problem. In the 2024 draft, it's all gone.
I just want to be clear, these are not public documents, these internal documents that you have had access to.
Right. These were basically emails being sent to people who are supposed to be making these changes, and then some, you know, sample documents, as well as the El Salvador one, which was just shared with me so I could get an idea what that crunch is going to look like. But eventually those will be released, but not the guidance on how it should be shortened up.
Got it. I'm sure that you reached out to the State Department to ask the obvious question of why. Have you heard back from the State Department? Why these changes?
Well, we did ask for comment. They declined to comment or answer any of our questions. But if you look at that memo with the guidance on editing, right at the top, it says the department is revising the reports to, quote, streamline the reports. But they're still supposed to say compliant with the law and with recently issued executive orders. But, you know, what we see here is that they're actually stripping out absolutely everything that's not specifically required to be reported by law. So things like torture, child labor, freedom of the press, they're still there, but freedom of expression for regular people, that's out. And I have to say, when you look at the laws that underline these reports, which were passed in the 60s and 70s, you have to wonder if these new minimized reports even fulfill the legal requirements. The law specifically says the reports should be full and complete, and that they should document violations of internationally recognized human rights. Some people would say that argues for a much broader set of reports than what we're seeing here.
NPR's Graham Smith, thanks for this and thanks for staying on it.
Sure thing.
So last week, a group of researchers who were studying a set of medieval books published their findings. They had been looking into the material used to make the book's covers.
In the Middle Ages, animal skins were the material of choice. But these covers were made from something these researchers had never seen before.
It was so unusual. It didn't look like anything else we see usually. Like usually it's calf skin, sheepskin, goatskin. We couldn't tell what it was.
That is Elodie Levesque. She's an associate professor at the Sorbonne University in Paris, where she teaches and practices book conservation. She says eventually the team had to use DNA analysis to identify what kind of animal skin was used for the covers.
I didn't really believe it, although it's quite accurate, that's the point, but I just couldn't believe it.
It was seal skin, as in R-R-R, which was surprising because the monks who made these books, they probably didn't know what a seal was.
These monks lived in Clairvaux. That's a very famous abbey founded almost 1,000 years ago in northern France, hundreds of miles inland from any ocean. Plus, as Levesque notes,
at the time, there's no seal on the French north coast. Also, there is no vernacular French word for seal.
Well, the images tell us they had never seen them before.
That is Matthew Collins, another researcher on the project. He and Levesque say it was clear the monks had no clue what a seal might look like, judging from a picture they drew in one of their books.
It basically looks like it's got a dog's head.
The face of a monster, the body of a calf.
It's got the weirdest looking kind of forked tail-like legs, four of them.
The legs of a fish tail.
Yeah, exactly. They're rubbish, right?
It doesn't look like a seal at all.
They had no idea. So these particular monks had never seen seals.
Never seen seals. So how did these monks get seal skins? Viking traders, perhaps? The DNA analysis suggests the skins came from as far away as Norway, Iceland, even Greenland.
Regardless of where they came from, Levesque says the seal skins were perfect for the job at hand.
Seal skins are very waterproof, so they would protect the parchment inside really well against the variations in humidity and temperature.
The books themselves would have looked very strange to modern readers. For starters, they were huge. It took two people to hold one.
And all you would see is the fur. It has a flap, so you can't even see there is a book inside. It's to me, it looks almost like a giant teddy bear in the shape of a book.
The books no longer look like teddy bears. Much of the fur is gone. But Levesque and Collins say more than 100 of them do survive.
And they provide not just an interesting cover story, but also an invaluable window into life hundreds of years ago.
It gives a lot of information about life in the Middle Ages and how monks were actually connected to the world.
Elodie Levesque and Matthew Collins, two of the researchers who studied a set of medieval books covered in seal skins.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Mathnasium, whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.